I know it depends on what part of Palestine you're in, but let's face it, overall, aid isn't getting through. And we've just simply got to say to Netanyahu's regime, enough is enough. You know, you can hold back the inevitable for a certain amount of time, but not forever.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me here on the Spotlight. Charlotte Caves, International Coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network out of Vancouver, and David William Perry, academic, author, and journalist out of Scotland. And thank you for staying with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the group right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa idh qala Ibrahim Rabbi arini kayfa tuhyi al-mauta qala awalam tu'min qala bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. And when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead, he said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel continues with its onslaught on the Gaza Strip, killing more women and children. Protests are held around the world in a show of solidarity with Palestinians and against Israeli crimes in the Gaza Strip. The Yemeni army says it's conducted new operations against the UK and US in retaliation for their aggression against the Arab nation. Our top story, Gaza has come under fresh air and artillery strikes as Israel remains intent on its genocidal campaign. Regime warplanes bombed areas of al-Nusayrat and al-Maghazi refugee camps in central Gaza. And to the north, Israeli artillery shelled an area near Beit Lahia and several people were killed in an attack on the western part of the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Eastern part of Rafah has also witnessed constant artillery shelling as a senior Israeli official says military is moving ahead with this planned ground invasion of the southern city. Israel launched its onslaught on Gaza in early October, and over 34,350 Palestinians have been killed thus far. Most of them have been women and children. Anti-Israel protests are gaining momentum on U.S. campuses as more and more university students are standing in solidarity with Palestinians. Students camped out for a second day at a George Washington University campus despite threats they could face temporary suspension. Students at Arizona State University also joined the wave of U.S. campus protests against ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. In the state of Illinois, Hundreds of protesters marched the University of Chicago campus. They echoed pro-Palestinian chants that have been reverberating through multiple American universities in recent days. Encampments in support of Palestine also continued at New York's Columbia University. The education center has been the epicenter of anti-Israel protests since the 18th of April. In over a week, hundreds of protesters have been arrested at colleges throughout the U.S. Protesting students demand university authorities divest from companies involved in Israel's military. And some of the students explained reasons behind growing anger on university campuses. Let's take a listen.
Dozens of universities across the United States who are rising up in solidarity with Gaza and to put an end to the Zionist U.S. genocide against our people. As we remain under the bombs of occupation, resisting genocide and grieving for our martyred colleagues and faculty, and witnessing the destruction of our universities, your global student solidarity is breaking boundaries, and it is time to smash the U.S. imperialist war machine. From Gaza to Columbia to Ann Arbor and Berkeley.
If you are not focusing on the brutal genocide currently happening in Gaza and the apartheid system Palestinians are living under in all of occupied Palestine, we implore you to do so. It is important to remember why we are here. Our encampment here at Columbia and encampments everywhere around the country are part of a larger movement for Palestinian liberation.
We've been in negotiations with the university since Friday, but increasingly we are met with an unwillingness to understand what are the core demands of the student movement. As we've said time and again, at the heart of this action, at the heart of this encampment, is the wish for a complete divestment and boycott of institutions that are complicit in Israel's genocide. Despite this, the university has proposed only further engagement with the apartheid state.
Right now we're here for Gaza because they say they're trying to wipe out Hamas when they're not, and they've shown it over and over again. They're not being precise, let's say, with their attacks. They've shown that they can be precise with something called a surgical strike, but they just haven't. And you know, bombing hospitals, universities, schools, ambulances, food trucks doesn't really show that you're trying to wipe out a resistance.
The students and other protesters are planning on staying here until all of the demands have been met, which include divesting from anything that has to do with the genocide, and also divulging what, opening the books, saying what is the funding for the school we go to.
We are doing this until we get our demands. We are doing this until the university, UCLA, divests, disclose, ends their silence, academic divestment, and does not continue to, or doesn't use police force for our peaceful protests. Those are our five demands. We will accomplish divestment. We are going to stay here until that. Without divestment, the siege will not end.
And protests and public demonstrations against Israeli genocidal war in Gaza are no longer limited to specific regions, but continue spreading across the globe with the participation of the student community everywhere. In Australia, students from universities of Sydney and Melbourne set up camps and protest Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. Over 100 students reportedly held a sit-in at the University of Melbourne alone. They held placards and chanted anti-Israel slogans. In Europe, students in France, Germany, and some other countries also held similar protests despite restrictions. At the Sciences Po University in Paris, students blocked an entrance to the campus while holding Palestinian flags and placards, as well as chanting slogans. In Berlin, demonstrators clashed with police in front of parliament. Several people were arrested as police violently cleared encampments. The protesters called on their governments to end providing funds and arms to the Israeli regime. Joining us now out of Melbourne is Nasser Mashni, president at Australia Palestine Advocacy Network. Hello, sir. Your thoughts on ongoing worldwide student demonstrations against Israel's genocide. Tell us about your activism and what students down under are saying about Israel's campaign of genocide against Gazans.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so very much for having me on the show. And I think what you've seen across the United States and now the world between Italy, France, Egypt, and now here on this continent in Australia, our two most prestigious brownstones. These are universities where the children of privilege overwhelmingly are the constituents, that they're putting their careers, their futures, their degrees on the line for Palestine. Now, this has only happened because the veneer of civility that Israel has enjoyed for so long has been shattered. The world is seeing, the world has seen, and privileged children in these really Ivy League schools, whether, you know, it's Princeton or Columbia, Yale and Harvard, MIT, and here at Sydney and Melbourne universities, that these children of privilege have seen and now feel compelled to speak up against the genocide. And in fact, what we should be normalizing is a word called scholasticide. That sits alongside genocide. Scholasticide is when the entire education system is destroyed. And as we know, Israel, in its genocidal campaign, has destroyed every level of education. And so these students are sitting there saying, my educational facility, because it's not speaking up against this scholasticide, because it has funding from companies that profit from the occupation and genocide, that they're not speaking out, that's unacceptable. And they're going to camp out, as you see in the encampments and the vision that you've got there, and they won't be broken. This is a generation of children that have bypassed the mainstream Murdoch media, Sky News and their affiliates, and they haven't been fed the poison that Israel is some sort of democracy. They know that it's a rogue apartheid state, and they're speaking up and out for justice and for Palestine.
Right, and Nasser, you know, we're beyond 200 days into this thing, and it's been an inhumane, highly disproportionate, extremely illegal and brutal campaign against civilians and civilian infrastructure since day one, back on October 7th. So why did it take students worldwide so long to mobilize, Nasser?
Look, everybody moves at their different speeds. The students have been involved and engaged in many of our rallies. Student strikes in Australia has been a thing since perhaps week three. This concept of the encampment is particularly, it's normalized in the United States, and we see a vision from Vietnam era, from the anti-Jim Crow era against Iraq invasions, Afghanistan invasions. And I think in the first instance, there was a movement towards mimicking that in solidarity with Columbia University and the over-policing of the student activism in the United States. But it's quickly pivoted back to where it needs to be, and that's solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza who are suffering at the most racist, genocidal campaign seen in history. Israel as an apartheid state with Zionism as its ideology is unfettered hate and racism. And when that is amplified by Western complicity, whether it be in the media, militarily, or from a government perspective, what you see is what we're seeing now. And you reported earlier on, sir, about 35,000 dead. There's no question the total is in excess of 50,000. And if they go into Rafah in any serious way, be under no illusion, the invasion of Rafah has started. It's just been an air campaign. And once the boots get on the ground in there, it'll exceed 100,000 Palestinians. And inside a calendar.
Right, right. Nasser, and American students say police have violated their rights to free speech, their rights to assemble, their rights for expression because they've been critical of Tel Aviv and its actions in this campaign of genocide. Are you guys suffering a similar fate down there in Australia when you speak up against the Israeli regime?
We haven't seen that yet, but certainly one of the things that is running current. If you have a look at what's happened, the escalation in violence to those students in America has run concurrent with this, the hoax that is the fear of Jewish students and anti-Semitism on those campuses. Many of the people that are first arrested are Jewish protesters who are standing in solidarity with the Palestinians. And the Americans and the Israelis have manufactured this storm to distract from the mass graves that have been found outside of Al-Shifa Hospital. Up to 1,500 people, many of them executed, bullet wounds in the head, cable tied behind their hands behind their bodies, children. It's a distraction, just as UNRWA and the funding around UNRWA was a distraction from the International Court of Justice, just as the assassination of the World Food Kitchen's 7 workers was a distraction from the EU and the UN's report on Israel using starvation as a weapon. This is a distraction to consume Western media audiences from the horrors that are happening on the ground in Gaza, and in particular the mass graves that have been discovered most recently.
Good point, and good to have you on, but stay safe, Nasser. Pleasure to speak to you from Melbourne. Nasser Mashni, President at Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network. Israeli forces have murdered 2 more Palestinians during fresh raids near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Mustafa Abed and Ashmed Shawana were shot dead by occupation forces in the vicinity of Salem checkpoint. Reports say the Israeli regime is refusing to hand over their bodies to their families. Israeli troops also raided the other towns and villages across the occupied West Bank, including Kafr Ain, northwest of Ramallah, Nablus, and Qalqilia. The Tel Aviv regime's intensified attacks across occupied territories since launching its war on Gaza in early October. Since then, nearly 500 Palestinians have now been killed by Israeli forces throughout the occupied West Bank. Thousands of Yemenis once again pour out into the streets of the capital Sana'a and several other cities to reaffirm their full support for Gazans. They also lauded their army's operations against Israeli-linked vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
Amid rising tensions in the international waterways and the departure of several Western warships from the Red Sea, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities across the country in yet another strong show of support for Palestine.
We took to the streets to protest for the women and children who are being killed by American and British weapons. Our naval forces will firmly continue operations as long as the aggression against the people of Gaza continues. And if the Yemenis are given the opportunity, there will be thousands of them rushing to fight for Palestine.
The Yemeni people are supporting and standing with our brothers in Gaza, and no sanction or action by United States and the United Kingdom will stop the Yemeni people. Yemeni people in Sana'a and other city continue and demonstrate weekly.
Protesters endorsed the Yemeni army's recent naval operations against Israeli-bound ships. They urged their armed forces to continue attacking the Israeli regime and its Western benefactors.
We support our naval and aerial forces operations, and we urge the army to continue destroying the enemies and do not allow any American, British, or Israeli ship to pass through our waters. Our army has targeted more than 100 ships, and the number will double unless the killing of the people of Gaza stops. We are ready to go and fight for the Palestinians in Gaza, and we promise that we can make Israel disappear.
In the latest development, the Yemeni army spokesman announced the targeting of the Israeli ship MSC Darwin in the Gulf of Aden with multiple drones and naval missiles. The Yemeni armed forces have also launched several ballistic missiles toward the Israeli-occupied city of Eilat.
Every week, Yemenis hold fresh rallies across the country to express their solidarity with Palestinians amid the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. People here vow that they will continue their support for Palestinians until the full liberation of the occupied territories. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust. From the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps. From the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the Limelight.
Lacking proper food and living in unsanitary conditions, the health of Gaza patients and people with disabilities has deteriorated. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Hala al-Asfat has two daughters with disabilities. One of her daughters, Feda, was diagnosed with lymphatic filariasis, commonly known as elephantiasis, when she was just 8 months old. Feda is now 23. Another daughter, Neda, was born with cirrhosis. She is now aged 21. Before the current Israeli regime genocide on the Gaza Strip, Hala did everything she could so that her daughters could be happy. Although the family are poor, they managed, with the help of donations, to furnish the sisters' room so that it would be as comfortable as possible. Hala made sure they got the best treatment she could find and brought them on regular day trips. Then, the Zionist regime's genocide began. On October 8, one day after Benjamin Netanyahu declared a major war against Gaza, Israel bombarded the area near where the family lived in Al-Karama, a Gaza City neighborhood. Hala and her son, Assad, struggled to find a car so that they could evacuate Fedah and Neda. Hala said, "I had to leave everything I worked hard for behind. That included her daughter's wheelchairs and their medical reports." Soon after they left their home, it was subjected to an Israeli regime airstrike. Hala and her daughters took shelter at a school in Gaza City's Beach refugee camp. They stayed there for about 3 weeks. When the Zionist regime carpet bombed the area, the family tried to escape. That meant Hala had to carry Neda while Assad carried Feda. In the panic of escaping, the family became separated. Hala reached Ashifa, Gaza's largest hospital, with Neda in her arms. When she arrived, she could not see Assad or Feda anywhere. Hala feared they had been martyred along the way. It came as a major relief to hear Assad's voice. He and Feda had actually arrived earlier at the hospital. Hala said, "I hugged Assad tightly, and I shed tears of joy." They spent just one night in the hospital, as it was so crowded with people who had been displaced. The next morning, they moved to a school in An-Nasr, another part of Gaza City, where they spent the following 2 weeks. During November, the school and other nearby buildings were surrounded by the Zionist regime troops in tanks. When the Zionist regime troops invaded, they searched the school for a few hours and interrogated the family before letting them go. Hala had to walk with her daughters among dead bodies left on the streets. Feda screamed repeatedly. They made it to a warehouse in Al-Daraj, a Gaza City neighborhood, where they took shelter. Around midnight, a building close to the warehouse was struck with a missile. Neda was hit in the face with shrapnel and fell to the ground. As Neda was motionless, Hala assumed she had been killed. Yet Neda soon began making a painful sound. She was bleeding profusely. The family lifted up Neda and rushed to Al-Ahli Hospital in Gaza City for treatment. Staff in that hospital had kept providing services even though it was the location of a huge explosion, which killed hundreds of people during October. Now the family are staying in another small warehouse. It is situated in the northern part of Gaza. Lacking proper food and living in unsanitary conditions, the health of both Neda and Feda has deteriorated. According to their mother, they both require surgery. Although they have suffered immensely, their mother is determined to maintain a positive attitude. She is hoping that the two young women will be able to receive the treatment they need outside Gaza as soon as possible. Meanwhile, the website of the New Arab wrote, "Disabling Palestinians in Gaza is a tactic and consequence of the Zionist regime's war machine rooted in Yitzhak Rabin's Break Their Bones directive from the First Intifada in 1988. 36 years later and 6 months into Israel's brutal assaults on Gaza, the Zionist regime continues to find new ways to cripple Gaza's resolve. From the reported use of the R-9X Hellfire missile on Ashifa Hospital courtyard, which shreds its victims, to the abuse of white phosphorus. Israel liberally employs new forms of sadism, leaving Gazans mourning the consequences. The statistics are harrowing. Every day in Gaza, more than 10 children lose a limb. Of the 1.4 million Palestinians in Gaza currently displaced, 15% have a disability. Before October 7th, a fifth of households in Gaza had at least one family member with a disability. Yet few realize how much former Israeli regime Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin influenced this culture of violence and how his doctrine has since evolved. Far removed from the myth of a peacemaker, Yitzhak Rabin's response to the non-violent intifada was to institute a policy of force, might, and beatings towards Palestinians, demanding that soldiers break their bones. The then war minister made maiming Palestinians part of the accepted norm in that period, confessed Israeli regime colonel Yehuda Meir at trial. This led a UN Human Rights Commission to conclude the Zionist regime's policies during the First Intifada constituted grave breaches of the Geneva Convention, declaring the Zionist regime's actions to be war crimes and an affront to humanity. When as now, the Western order seems to be addicted to rewarding those who violate its own principles. The Zionist regime remains the main beneficiary of this cognitive dissonance. Its signature on the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities in 2012, a mockery of international law. Rather than taking all the necessary measures to protect persons with disabilities in armed conflict, persons with mobility issues in Gaza have fled on the backs of family members, leaving their wheelchairs behind. Those with developmental disabilities are prone to seizures. A population is left traumatized, with no shelter and unable to shield themselves from attack. The only thing that has changed since the days of Rabin is more sophisticated weaponry. Rifles and batons have been replaced with artificial intelligence, kill zones, and airstrikes. But the method and aim remain the same: to crush the hope and bones of Palestinians. Look back at 2018 Great March of Return to see Rabin's legacy in action. Once again, a peaceful protest was set upon by the Israeli regime army, resulting in 5,972 documented injuries, 493 aimed at upper limbs and 4,903 at lower limbs, according to the UN Independent Commission report. 940 children were left permanently disabled. Rabin's break-their-bones tactic evolved into shoot-to-maim. Literal generations of Palestinians have been left impaired as a result. Today in Gaza, it's not enough to survive the airstrike. The battle to live is ongoing. 80,000 Gazans have been injured thus far. Without a ceasefire, projections estimate the number could rise to up to 170,329, with approximately 86,545 going on to succumb to their injuries either due to untreated wounds or unexploded ordnance. Every minute that Israel's war on Gaza continues, the risk for persons with disabilities increases. Post-traumatic stress disorder is endemic in Gaza, fueling a downward spiral into death as psychological trauma begets physical injury. In a war where the Israeli regime targets civilians at will and humanitarian aid trickles in at a spiteful speed, the Zionist regime's tactic of targeting disabled individuals is further proof of genocide, rendering international conventions null and void. But despite the West whitewashing his image and giving him the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts, we remember him for who he was and what he did. Yitzhak Rabin, was the architect of a vicious strategy that inflicted as much suffering on the Palestinian people as possible. No cloak of peace can ever hide that.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Iran's anti-ship missiles.
Part 1.
In the mid-1980s, Bandar Abbas. Although the aerial routes were very unsafe for passenger planes and the Iraqi Ba'athist Air Force would attack any plane without any restrictions, the plane landed in Bandar Abbas, so then President Ayatollah Khamenei would get out of it. The Iranian president was there to inspect the newly established IRGC's naval forces capabilities. The forces were guarding the Iranian maritime borders in the Persian Gulf in the face of U.S. troops. Ayatollah Khamenei inspected a section where the IRGC experts were making silkworm missiles. The idea of reverse engineering the missiles that reached Iran from North Korea after going through a tortuous path had obsessed Iranian experts for a while. Further afield, one of the missiles was fired with Ayatollah Khamenei in attendance.
The USS Savannah sustains a direct hit from a bomb.
The first days of the Second World War. The Americans still think what is destroying their ships are bombs. The Germans had a major problem. The Allied forces' battleships were of different anti-air types, and the fighter jets didn't have enough visibility to target them. So, they made a special type of bomb that could be fired out of the vision of the ships. They could move towards the target by an operator and would go off before the ship could even see it. There was no way the Westerners could find out how the Germans were dropping these bombs from a high altitude, and the bomb would hit them right in the middle of their ships. But it was a fact. The Germans had designed small wings for the bombs. The wings were guided with radio frequencies from inside the plane and would change the course of the bomb towards the target. The missile would initially go through the ship's armor with a timed warhead and would go off deep inside the ship and then explode. Hence, the enemy was definitely done. Gradually, the Westerners realized that the Germans were using a new technology. They fired the missiles towards the ships and then guided them. It was the beginning of the emergence of the guided anti-ship missile. The Americans transferred the knowledge to the bombs that were capable of hitting targets on the ground. In this video, you can see that the guided bombs are dropped from a very high altitude to destroy a bridge on the river. Immediately after World War II, the Soviet Union realized it was an inferior position to NATO, the Western Military Alliance, in terms of the number of aircraft carriers. From this day on, which started in the Cold War, the Soviets decided to find a way to easily sink the huge vessels instead of manufacturing them. The Germans provided them with the initial technology. Defeating Germany was tied to getting access to Germany's advanced military technology. Now, instead of churning out a large number of aircraft carriers at high costs, the Russians made a very large number of missiles for defense on the shores at low costs. Each of these iron chambers were capable of firing a large missile towards enemy ships. The Soviet Union started to develop the missiles, but the West was not interested in developing anti-ship missiles until 1966, when an Egyptian boat sank an Israeli ship with a Russian missile. The importance of owning the horrifying weapon was now becoming clear for the U.S. Naval experts should have realized that the importance of weapons on ships had long faded away and a new era had begun for such weapons. However, the French had discovered the fact long before the Americans, but they didn't dare change course until the Israeli ship sank. After the Israeli ship was torpedoed, the issue became interesting for everyone. Meanwhile, the U.S. did not want to lag behind, so it put manufacturing anti-ship missiles high on its agenda. At that time, the majority of the countries favored missiles that could be fired from planes. France had already made a sea launch type of it. So the French experts made efforts to make the air launch type as well. Until the Israeli ship was drowned, no country felt the need to possess the missile. But soon, France equipped all of its ships with this type of missile and earmarked a research fund for the air launch type. 5 years before the Islamic Revolution in Iran, France started making the air launch Exocet missile. The missile was fired from the F-1 Mirage, which had a very long range and super-flown helicopters. France worked hard on developing the Exocet missile so it could even be fired from submarines. The reason for the development was to make the submarine very close to the enemy target in order to fire the missile. After firing the first torpedo, the location of the submarine would be revealed and the hidden weapon would turn into an easy prey. But by firing long-range cruise missiles, only 2 years after the Iran-Iraq War, the submarine type of the missile was also made. The naval cruise missile works like this. After it's fired, it lowers the altitude and gets close to the water level and minimizes the possibility of detection. Then it moves above the water level and strikes its target. The confrontation showed itself during the six-day Arab-Israeli conflict. Israeli warships were equipped with long-range maritime missiles and easily demolished the Egyptian and Syrian warships. A year after Iraq waged war against Iran, on the other side of the planet, an important war broke out. Britain and Argentina were at loggerheads over the Falkland Islands. During the battle, the Argentine aircraft were fitted with French Exocet missiles. The missiles were fired from a high altitude to demolish the enemy vessels. In one of the incidents of shooting the missiles, two anti-ship Exocet cruise missiles hit a British ship and destroyed it. The Exocet could also be fired from a vessel. It turned out to be one of the greatest anti-ship missiles and kept its status for half a century. In the beginning of the Iraq War against Iran, while the West had imposed a weapon sanctions on Iran, France decided to provide the Ba'athist Iraqi army with the missile along with the launcher aircraft and helicopters. Iran's diplomatic protest didn't change anything. The Exocet was installed on fighter jets that were not sold to Iraq. For the first time in the world, a Western country had rented out its fighters to another country to attack civilian ships with them. The situation was getting harder for Iran every day. The Iraqi Ba'athist regime's ships would strike any Iranian oil tanker or any tanker that was carrying goods for Iran. Iran's oil lifeline was about to be cut off. Pretty soon, Iran equipped the fast fishing boats with air launch systems. It confronted the Iraqi and Kuwaiti battleships with the most basic weapons. It was in those days when the U.S. entered the Persian Gulf to protect Iraq's oil in the face of Iran's attacks. Saudi Arabia gave Iraq the thumbs up to use its airspace and AVAC's telecommunications systems. The French Mirage with Iraqi pilots could fly for such a long distance that it could fly across the Persian Gulf and move back. The American AVAC spotted the Iraqi Mirage jets, but ordered the Saudi F-15 fighters not to show any reaction. But the aircraft wasn't the Mirage. It was a civilian Falcon that had the Exocet missile. The Iraqis were so eager to strike any ship on that sea that in an unprecedented incident, they fired two Exocet missiles towards the USS Stark ship. The commander on board the ship ordered both defense systems to remain on alert. The electronic warfare and shooting the missile at a close range were on complete standby, but it was too late. The first missile struck the ship in the middle of the hull and completely destroyed the body. Quite accidentally, the warhead of the missile did not go off and the Stark survived the first attack. But it wasn't that lucky in the second strike. The second warhead exploded and the ship was engulfed in fire. More than 30 people died in the attack. The Americans claimed they turned off their anti-missile systems since the aircraft was Iraqi. But the claim did not go well with their presence in a war zone in the Persian Gulf. It showed how dangerous the Exocet is. Besides the Exocet, Iraq had purchased silkworm missiles from China. The missiles were not as accurate as the Exocet, but it would take only one of them to send a battleship or a commercial ship into the depths of the sea. Iran had to do something. Iran carried out one of its first reprisal attacks by the silkworm missiles looted from Iraq. At least two Iraqi air bases in Fob were captured by Iranian forces. The first missile attack by the IRGC's newly established naval forces was carried out by the missiles looted from Iraq in 1986. The Al-Bakar and Al-Umayya oil platforms were hit. Later on, North Korea gave Iran a few of the missiles. The IRGC's commanders are standing here in line, so Ayatollah Khamenei descends the stairs to join them. They flew Ayatollah Khamenei on a helicopter to the place where the IRGC silkworm missiles were kept. IRGC Minister Mohsen Rafiqdoust was also present. The president was informed of the details of the missile. Then, he was flown to the site of the missile launch on a helicopter. Some IRGC forces were preparing the missiles for launch near the coast. The biggest problem for the silkworm missile is the time-consuming preparation and launch. Ayatollah Khamenei left the site to say prayers. After the prayers, the IRGC minister and president were in the VIP stand. The missile was ready for launch with the president's order to hit the target. The president stood in the stands. The code was announced and the missile was launched. Iran successfully fired its first coast-to-sea missile. The Silkworm missile. It has the heaviest anti-ship warhead, the first imported cruise. It enjoys simple technology with massive destruction power. It was the first missile made with reverse engineering with the capability for firing from coast to sea. It can be fired from aircraft as well. But the coast to sea missile that takes so much time for its preparation will be troublesome as it reveals its location. The missile isn't long distance and it should be launched from the coast. It will help the enemy spot its location and then bomb it. Anyway, despite the risks, Iran joined the club of silkworm missile producers. The IRGC has designed ranks and uniforms for its forces. So the images date back to the mid-90s. We can see the IRGC forces working on silkworm missiles. The missile has been fired in all IRGC drills time and again. Mostly, the drills with the missiles were held in the 1980s. Iran quickly moved on to make indigenous types. Yet the speedboats that used to fire the light rockets were the backbone of the IRGC's naval forces in the 80s and 90s. The Americans were still confused to figure out what the newly emerged phenomenon in the Persian Gulf was. During the war in 1987 and 1988, despite possessing 80 ships and over 500 military aircraft in the region, they failed to stop the Iranian speedboats. In addition, Iran had the capability to spread mines. The IRGC's naval mines could seriously damage the enemy's oil tankers and commercial ships and increase the risks to maritime routes for Iraq. they were also successful in damaging the humongous U.S. ships. The Samuel Roberts frigate was one of them. Even the commercial ships that were directly escorted by the U.S. warships were not safe in the face of the IRGC mines. Things developed in a way that the Silkworm missile became a sensitive agent in conflicts in the Persian Gulf. Diplomatic discussions about imposing a ban on Iran's access to the missiles even reached the United Nations. Pressure mounted to stop the process of delivering the missiles to Iran. According to some sources, including the Kuwaiti media, Iran was eyeing modern and more advanced Chinese C-801 missiles. The missile was modeled after the French anti-ship Exocet missile. It was smaller and lighter than the Silkworm, which was copied after the Stux missile made by the former Soviet Union. The C-801 missile did not reach Iran during the war. But after the war, a few of them did reach Iran, and they were even test-fired on the Army's Air Force's Phantom fighters. But what was developed with Iran's participation, and whose production line was given to Iran, was the C-802. That was how the newer missile was born. The newer missile, the first long-range Iranian cruise missile. Reverse-engineered from the Chinese Silkworm. Range, 150 kilometers. The launchers are camouflage trucks. It poses an indigenously built Iranian radar and motor with small possibility of diversion. Compared to the first generation of anti-ship cruise, the Nur is a special missile. Its small size is comparable to the Silkworm, and it reduces the possibility of tracking and destruction by the enemy. According to the assessment by the U.S. Navy, after Russian anti-ship missiles, the C-802 Chinese cruise and the Iranian type are the second gravest risks. The Nur is equipped with a 175-kilogram warhead and is specially designed to operate against ships. It can sink a 100-ton vessel. This type of warhead can increase the capability to penetrate the ship's hulls. Therefore, it would only take one or perhaps two of these missiles to ruin a huge vessel. The indigenous production of the ships would guarantee the possibility of firing a large number of them.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. I have two special guest speakers for today's discussion, Shaykh Habib and Shaykh Nur Muhammad. Shaykh Habib, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure.
You're welcome, brother. And Shaykh Nur Mahpur, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
So for today's topic, we want to talk about the religion of Islam and whether the religion of Islam respects environment and the rights of animals or not. How much environment and the rights of animals are important regarding the religion of Islam, Shaykh Habib?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa ali baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. It's very important whenever we talk about a topic and we want to see the view of Islam on it, to go back to the time of an-nas, zaman an-nas, the time of the giving of the sayings and hadith and the views at the time and how they were living at the time. When reading that, we see that it's different towards our time. But yet, still, the topic that was brought up was still available during that time. And we see that in the Holy Quran, there's a base that all this, the environment, the animals that are available, are blessings from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the human beings. We see in various sayings, especially in the sayings, for example, in Kitab al-Jihad, where the sayings, the orders from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi is to respect, for example, the trees, the environment that you go into, to not make complete destruction when you go into a city or a place. We also see in the sayings of keeping animals in houses, specific animals, for example, al-hamam. Ad-dijaj, ad-dik, roosters and pigeons.
Yes.
And for example, I've seen a couple of sayings that from the Imam, seeing a man who has birds in a cage, and would tell them that if you're going to treat them well, keep them with you. If you're not going to treat them well, let them be, let them fly.
Mm-hmm.
Let them gain their rizq from another place.
Yes.
And we see that the Imam alayhi salam give the laws of justice, regulated laws for, you know, treating animals and, you know, respecting the environment. Cleaning, if you want to talk about, you know, like having a clean environment is also considered about protecting the environment. Cleaning is something very important in the eyes of Sharia of Islam. Okay. And you know, not oppressing, not oppressing the animals.
Not whipping, not lashing. Not
Do not hit the face of the horses. Adil al-Sharaya, Sheikh al-Saduq has a saying, do not hit the faces of the horses because they worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's all right. Thank you very much. We'll get back to more details about the rights of animals. But Shaykh Nur Muhammad, what's your idea regarding religion of Islam and whether in Islam,